Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The idea of immigration reform remains hugely controversial in this country, and just when it seems that progress and compromise are possible, inevitably that progress is dashed and stalemate resumes. Yet as of 2012, there were 11.7 undocumented immigrants in this country. Many family members of legal residents, others undocumented parents with U.S. citizen children, others here for temporary or migrant work. My guest today has long written about the immigrant story and history in the United States, on immigration policy and its breakdown and possible fixes. Roberto Suro is a former journalist and professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, where he directs the Tomas Rivera Policy Institute, which explores the challenges and opportunities of demographic diversity in 21st century American cities. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Prior to joining USC, he was the director of the Pew Hispanic Center and helped launch the Pew Research Center. He began his career as a journalist with the Chicago Sun-Times, later wrote and edited at the Chicago Tribune, Time Magazine, the New York Times, and the Washington Post. He's the author of several books, including Strangers Among Us, Latino Lives in a Changing America, Watching America's Door, The Immigration Backlash and the New Policy Debate, and his most recent, Writing Immigration, Scholars and Journalists in Dialogue. He'll be speaking, answering questions, and signing copies of his book this evening at 7 o'clock at the Martin Regional Library at 2601 South Garnett Road as a part of the work of the Tulsa City County Library's Hispanic Resource Center. Roberto Suro is my guest today. Roberto Suro, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Rich.
At the close of 2012, conventional wisdom was that if the federal government didn't do anything in the next 2 years, if it did only one thing in the next 2 years, it would be immigration reform. Yet here we are nearly 2 years later, and nothing has changed in this debate. In fact, if anything, the debate has gotten more shrill than a couple of years ago and as shrill as it's been over the last 10 to 15 years. What happened?
Well, I'll differ a little bit with your description of events. And since in the first half of 2013, the Senate did negotiate and pass a very wide-reaching immigration reform that included a compromise between major business interests and labor unions on temporary workers and a number of other measures that required a lot of give and take on both sides, and represented a significant compromise among a variety of players. So that was accomplished. I mean, there was, and this was done entirely in Congress. The administration didn't present a plan. You had Republicans and Democrats actually sitting down together, pro-immigration forces, restrictionists, the whole panoply did actually come to a resolution and was able to pass a bill, with not an insignificant achievement. And the failure then was to take that and move it towards enactment, and which, where the ball was dropped, was between the Senate and the House.
True. Yeah, as I say, it's only one House of Congress, unfortunately.
Yeah. You know, and what happened there fits better your description. There was a lot of polarization. People with very hard-line positions on all sides of the debate kind of dug in, and the ability to compromise was gradually eroded, and rhetoric escalated, and the thing fell apart. Really, it was pretty well dead by the end of 2013.
I'm wondering, do you think the Senate could still pass that bill today, though? Haven't sort of positions hardened on both sides of the aisle and both parts of the Congress?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's very hard to speculate about what, you know, there's a close vote and some votes may likely have changed. And now we're, you know, instead of being right after an election, we're right before an election. So, you know, the world has moved on. But there was a very elaborate compromise position that was negotiated and put in writing and enacted.
Given the fact that it seems to have failed in this latest two-year Congress, what are the practical impacts of that?
The one thing everybody agrees on is that the current system doesn't work for anybody in any part of it, whether it's a matter of trying to control unauthorized migration or promote the kind of legal migration that's most beneficial to the economy and society, managing refugee flows, any part of it. See, the system, the cost all of it, everybody agrees, is broken, and that laws really don't mirror contemporary realities, and that the mechanisms are largely ineffective and overly costly. So we'll continue sort of puttering along with a status quo that nobody really likes very much. And now, given the election cycles, you know, it seems there's some very small chance that something might happen during the lame duck session of this Congress, but I doubt it a lot. And the conventional wisdom is that Washington won't act on the issue in advance of a presidential election. So we're looking, you know, 3, maybe 4 years before there's another window for serious policymaking on this issue.
And it seems like in this last 2 to 4 years, because of this vacuum from the federal government to sort of fix this problem, you have state governments stepping in, and oftentimes with far more regressive legislation. What's the impact of that?
Well, we're seeing actually states in both directions. I mean, there are some states that are taking quite punitive steps, and others that are taking rather welcoming steps, specifically in terms of unauthorized immigrants. There's not an enormous amount that states can do about legal immigration, but there is some, and there's certainly a lot that local governments can do to create an atmosphere that is more conducive to success for legal immigrants. And you have people going in opposite directions all over the country, and so there's a growing kind of patchwork where the circumstances really are very different from one place to another.
You've written that Americans look at immigration in a pretty much a binary fashion. You're either legal or illegal. And that's a very limited viewpoint. In fact, you said that's only about 2 ways out of 100 or more than 100 of ways of looking at immigration. Can you elaborate on what you meant by that?
In contemporary migration patterns, what we see, you know, starting with highly skilled legal immigrants, there are often people who want to retain ties to their home country, and they have businesses in their home countries, but want the ability to come to the United States and work for a while, then go back and forth, and really live a kind of transnational lifestyle. It's very common among some very highly skilled young people in the high-tech industries, for example. And the opportunity to move around is something we see growing in other parts of the world. Europe, for example, has adopted policies that aim to encourage movement back and forth so people can move towards economic opportunity and then leave when those opportunities dry up. We've always thought of ourselves as such a big country that once you're in the United States, there's everything you possibly want. It's basically here. At the other sides of immigration, because we've had this sort of long-standing federal regime of laws that are very imperfect, and a substantial flow of people either outside the system or on the margins of the system, we now have a very large population of people who are in gray areas. Large numbers of people who have applied for family reunification visas, have been approved, but are then put on a wait list that might be 5, 10, 15 years. Many of those people are here, and they're here, out of status. But they, rather than wait in their home countries, they're with their families here. You've got many, many people who came to this country illegally, have been living here without authorization, but have either married U.S. citizens or given birth to U.S. citizens. So out of the 11 million or so who are unauthorized migrants in the U.S., best estimates are that somewhere between 3 and 5 million of them are the immediate relatives of U.S. citizens. And if they were legal, they would be eligible for immediate immigration benefits and the ability to live here legally. And so we're multiplying these people who live in these kind of gray zones. And in fact, the world is multiplying the kind of people who want to live in gray zones, who may spend part of their time in the United States and part of their time someplace else. So our laws really haven't adapted to that very well. A lot of what the Senate bill tried to do with employment visas was to create more of those kind of possibilities, particularly for people with either desirable skills or who have the capital to create investments, jobs, creating businesses in the United States, give them the opportunity to come here, have a foot in the United States, but not have to sort of burn their boats and say, I'm coming in America, I'm never going back to wherever the country of origin may be.
I think you wrote that it says, we hope that most of those immigrants will be like that, but to acknowledge that reality that many immigrants will only come to work for amount of time. Maybe it's a portion of a year, maybe it's 2 to 3 years, but then we'll go back to their home country. When you actually put the shoe on the other foot, there are plenty of Americans leaving this country to work as expatriates, to live for a portion of time. Some live for decades or more, but still keep their American citizenship and really come back frequently and consider themselves Americans. It seems like maybe a lot of the places in the rest of the world are doing better at accommodating those types of, if you would, world citizens better than we do.
Yeah, no, there's no question. A lot of our economic competitors, particularly in Europe, but also in emerging markets, have immigration setups that are just more flexible in terms of that ability to come stay for a long period of time or a short period of time, work, go back and forth, and not necessarily have to sort of declare that you're here in place. The tricky part in the U.S., U.S. has very limited temporary work visas, and when the economy is doing even modestly well as it is now, all of those spaces get taken up and there are applicants left who have to just have no opportunity to come here as temporary workers. The general sense of our system is that when somebody comes and becomes a legal permanent resident, we sort of think of them as citizens in training. I mean, we expect them to stay. And if they want to become a citizen, they can't leave for extended periods of time. You know, you're a legal permanent resident, and you leave for a long period of time, you can lose that status and have to reapply for it. So our notions are somewhat set in the vision of a settler nation where, you know, people came here to make their homes permanently and have a really almost a pre-industrial view of the notion of mobility. When you have people who live on airplanes and they're moving capital and goods and ideas around the world in digits, it's a very antiquated way of thinking of immigration.
My guest today is Roberto Sotero, a former journalist and a professor of communication and public policy at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Southern California. He directs the Tomas Rivera Policy Institute on Demographic Diversity in the 21st Century. He'll be a guest of the Tulsa City County Library on immigration issues at the Martin Regional Library tonight at 7 o'clock. His most recent book is Writing Immigration, Scholars and Journalists in Dialogue. He joins us by phone today here on Studio Tulsa. When we talk about these huge backlogs and the fact that people can't get into the country, I think there's a perception that what we're talking about is cheap, semi-skilled, unskilled labor. Are we equally at bat at accommodating highly skilled workers in which we have shortage? You know, because it's one thing if we're producing enough labor to satisfy a highly skilled industry. But if we're not, it seems like in the interest of competitiveness, we should allow that immigration and should encourage that immigration. Are we doing a bad job at that too?
Certainly the business community and the folks who run those businesses argue vociferously that we're doing a bad job. Native-born workers in tech industries tend to push back and say, no, we don't need a whole lot of foreign workers. So there is some, and that was part of the argument that we had in 2013 in a hard-fought but negotiated settlement that would have greatly increased the size of temporary worker programs and additionally made it much easier for somebody who comes to school in the United States in a science or technology, education, medicine, the so-called STEM fields, to stay and then after they graduate, move into a job here much easier than it is now and to stay for an extended period of time. The way it works now is somebody finishes a master's degree in electronic engineering in the U.S. and is from overseas, when it's a complicated an extended series of steps, and there are plenty of places where you don't make it, where it's possible that even though you're here and somebody wants to hire you, you're not able to stay. And fixing that was one of the major objectives of the immigration reform efforts that, you know, have been tried and failed now over the course of 10 years. This was going back to, you know, George W. Bush was adamant about this really 10 years ago, saying we really, in order to remain competitive, we need to fix this so that we're not basically training our competition by having people come to a school in the United States, you know, a terrific, you know, petrochemical engineering degree at OU, and then go someplace else when there's a business in Oklahoma City or Tulsa who wants to hire them on the spot. Instead, they graduate, get on an airplane, and take that talent that we've helped nurture someplace else. So that's really one of the big objectives that remains unaccomplished in this agenda.
Well, of course, that gets into the other area of this huge problem of immigration. Are there true shortages in a skilled field, or is this just an effort to create more supply than demand and keep wages down?
Well, this gets to a really interesting, complicated
argument
where, you know, business creators say, if you give us the talent, these people have multiplier effects. So that if you hire a highly skilled innovator in a technical field, they actually generate jobs. So for every one of those kind of people you hire, they'll create other jobs and generate overall increases in productivity, and everybody's better for it in the end. So it's one of those questions that's a bit in the eye of the beholder, but the preponderance of evidence tends to be on the side of the folks who argue that overall the economy does better with when you bring in people who are innovators and experts. You know, the other side of it is that this is a transformational economy where we've been now for 20 years or more. There are always losers.
Yeah.
And those people tend to be very sore about the fact that the world has changed under their feet.
Well, and even for the people that are employed, you see an awful lot of stagnant wages overall in the economy, up to, you know, the very highest percentiles of the population. So it is a very complicated question, as you alluded to. I want to ask about the most recent book, which I think you're going to be discussing while you're here. It's Writing Immigration, Scholars and Journalists in Dialogue. What are some of the most interesting policy ideas that came out of that experience of putting that book together?
Oh, yeah, it's interesting. One of the questions we try to examine in that book was the extent to which ideas themselves have shaped the debate, and whether the public has been well served either by the community of experts who tend to create policy options, or the media professions that then pick the circumstances. And in some ways, you can draw a fairly negative, unfortunately, draw a fairly negative conclusion, given the fact that we're looking at now what has been a 10-year stalemate in federal policy. The policy options have not necessarily been articulated terribly well, and it may be that the idea of one giant sweeping federal reform, which Congress has been trying to do now since 2006, was not a good idea. That may not have been the best way to do it. That was very much an idea that was cultivated in the policy community among policy experts and academics and advocates, and, you know, it didn't work. I mean, it's the one thing, whether it was a good idea or a bad idea, politically, it turned out to be untenable. And the media narratives of immigration, I think, have, to a substantial extent, fueled the polarization on this issue in a way that it's made it harder to make policy. And there are a variety of ways in which that's happened. Media coverage has tended to increase anxiety over the whole question. So, for example, we've been talking here about legal immigration, economic opportunities, all kinds of things like that. Most of these conversations, and I'm sure most of your interviews, have focused on unauthorized migration and the border and police activities meant to enforce federal policies that aim at reducing the unauthorized population. That one issue has so dominated our debate, I think to a certain extent, it's poisoned the whole thing.
Is it politically tenable to try to tackle immigration reform in these small incremental steps or taking a small piece of the puzzle? Because it seems like the areas that aren't going to be addressed are not going to allow for progress in another area.
Well, that's been the assumption so far. I mean, the basic idea has been it takes a grand bargain, and that that you have to fix, you know, the scientists and the unskilled workers all at the same time, or it doesn't work politically. Well, that formula hasn't worked. What the alternatives are and how they may work is a whole another question. To a certain extent, I think the next time to really start talking about this is in about 3 years. Because I think there's really little chance. We'll be tinkering on the edges, and the president has promised to take some executive action which could produce temporary fixes, you know, on a couple of fronts. But, any real overall change in policy is something that's probably not will wait the next president, and not even this Congress, but the Congress that's elected with the next president in 2016. And then they take office in 2017. It takes a year to sort of hash out these issues, where all of a sudden we're talking about 2018, which is kind of crazy. that this issue really likely, aside from tinkering, and there will be, I suspect there will be tinkering in the next before the Obama presidency is over. And it may affect a significant number of lives, and it's going to be very politically controversial if he does what he says he's going to do and what people in the White House are talking about doing this December.
Yeah, doing this after the election, how's this likely to affect the election? I know you've been on a couple of media outlets recently where you've talked about how, you know, and when we talk about immigration, a lot of times it is the American Latino community that we're concerned about and talk about in regards to this issue. What are their reactions? I mean, I'm sure they're all over the map, but what's the general consensus?
Well, I mean, the polling suggests that American Latinos are not happy with the way the immigration issue has played out, and they're not happy with either party. A lot of it in the past, voting behavior on this issue among Latinos has been driven more as a negative reaction than as a positive reaction. So when you have candidates that speak harshly about immigration, and when there people attempt to sort of demonize immigrants, particularly unauthorized, particularly Hispanic immigrants, people get their backs up, not surprisingly. And that often motivates a negative reaction. So in 2012, Obama and the Democrats in general did very well among Latino voters. I think that's a large part of that is because the Republican candidates in the nomination process spent a lot of time during those endless debates trying to outdo each other on who could be toughest on immigration and really indulged in some really harsh rhetoric. And Mitt Romney, who started out with a somewhat moderate position on this issue, ended up saying some things that sounded quite outlandish, like he was, his policy would be to, induce people to self-deport, I mean, basically make life so unpleasant that they'll leave. And that didn't sit well. So in this election, in the midterm election, the real battlegrounds are places where there's relatively small shares of Latino votes. So there's in terms of the Senate in particular, none of the races that are currently on the table are going to be significantly influenced by Latinos. So we'll see then the question is what happens in 2016 and in particular, what kind of dynamics we see in the Republican nomination process on this issue.
My guest today is Roberto Suro, former journalist, a professor of communication and public policy at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Southern California. He'll be speaking at the Tulsa City County Library's Martin Regional Library on immigration issues this evening at 7. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I want to leave with one very provocative thing you wrote about 5 years ago when the Statue of Liberty reopened. And I'm sorry to bring this up, but it is an interesting, it gets to this heart of our understanding or our perceived understanding or perceived misunderstanding about immigration. You said we should remove Emma Lazarus's poem, The New Colossus, Give Us Your Poor, Your Tired, Your Huddled Masses Yearning to Be Free, from the statue, because it has nothing to do with American liberty as the Statue of Liberty represents, and immigration as we understand it.
I mean, it was a very provocative kind of argument, and it was meant to stimulate conversation. But basically, the point, I was making a couple of points. One, the statue was not about immigration. It was about the concept of liberty in the United States and some really enduring fundamental values about what this country represents. And it kind of coincidentally, you know, the story of the poem is really a side story to the purpose of the statue. It wasn't set up, you know, as welcome to the harbor. In any case, the poem is incorrect in the way it characterizes immigrants. You know, it's not the poor and the huddled masses and the tired. Those people tend to stay home. Immigrants by nature, firstly, tend to be doers. They tend to be people who say, you know, I'm going to pick up and go someplace entirely new because I think I can make a better life. So the characterization is fundamentally wrong in a really important way of how you think about these people. Most people don't immigrate. Even in lousy places that are really bad, whether environmentally, criminally, economically, socially, politically, throughout history, all over the world, even today, the great majority of people stay put. And there's some small percentage, 2.5-3% of the world population, decides to pick up and move. And so they're not the poor and the tired and the tempest-tossed. And lastly, what concerns me is the notion that the United States has this sort of God-given ability to absorb immigrants, that it's just sort of in the dirt, that it's in the water in the Mississippi River, that it's in the snow in the Rocky Mountains. It's just part of who we are. We're a nation of immigrants, and we just do well at it. You know, we've had a history of ups and downs, successes and failures, like on any other issue, and it's hard work, and it has to be deliberate work. And it requires sitting and deciding, what does it mean to be a nation of immigrants today? And it certainly doesn't mean the same thing that it did when Emma Lazarus wrote those words more than 100 years ago.
Roberto Cirro, I appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Roberto Cirro is a professor in the Annenberg School for Communications and Journalism at the University of Southern California, where he directs the Tomas Rivera Policy Institute. His most recent book is titled Writing Immigration, Scholars and Journalists in Dialogue. He'll be talking about that book, speaking, answering questions, and signing copies of his book this evening at 7 o'clock at the Martin Regional Library at 2601 South Garnett Road. He's a guest of the Tulsa City County Library's Hispanic Resource Center. For more information, visit TulsaLibrary.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.